morning, ladies and gentlemen. The President of the United States is in Chicago today, guest of the American Farm Bureau Federation. He is to be the principal speaker on the opening program of the three-day annual convention of the Federation being held in the big international amphitheater at the Union Stockyards. The President's train arrived in the yard just 15 minutes ago, and he and the members of his party have just arrived on the platform here in the amphitheater. This amphitheater has been the scene of the great international livestock show during the past week, but has now been transformed into a big meeting hall with a placement of seats in the arena and the erection of the stage. All of the 8,500 permanent gallery seats are filled, and altogether some 12,500 persons are here to welcome the nation's chief executive.
My fellow farmers, the American Farm Bureau Federation, nationwide organization of thinking farmers of the United States, is hope today to its most distinguished member. The United Forces of American Agriculture assembled here and throughout the length and breadth of the United States to counsel and deliberate upon questions of momentous significance to American welfare. We have asked our distinguished fellow citizen to meet with us. His work, his humanitarian philosophy, his idealism, his courage, his leadership now are being written into the pages of worldwide history. Mr. President, I present to you, your fellow Americans, ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the President of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, I marvel at how organized farming has grown. The last time that I spoke to the representatives of the organized farmers of America was, as I remember it, in this same city, in 1929, or perhaps 1930. And at that time, you could have put all of the representatives of farm organizations into one fairly small hotel room. And now look at this guy. Going back not so far, but just 3 years. In the autumn of 1932, in addressing the farmers of the nation, I reminded them that the economic life of the United States is a seamless web. That was a means of illustrating the great dependence of each economic unit in the nation upon every other unit. Farm prosperity, in other words, as we know today, cannot exist without city prosperity, and certainly city prosperity cannot exist without farm prosperity. And it is therefore especially appropriate for you, as representatives of the farmers of the nation, to meet here in this great metropolis of the Middle West, here in Chicago, where the interests of agriculture are interwoven with the interests of other industries serving the nation's needs. Here is a common meeting ground of agriculture and transportation and industry and labor. Only a few generations ago, in fact, when some of us old people were young, interdependence between agriculture and industry, was not in any way as great as it is today. But now your welfare depends in part on what you in the country do, and also in large part on what people do in the cities as well. Your own experience of 3 and 4 years ago, doubtless brings all of this vividly to your mind. Your suffering, those sufferings of rural America, were not because you were not producing, for your granaries and storehouses were bursting with the products of your labor, but because things in city and country had both got out of balance, and purchasing power had declined to the point where people in the cities didn't have the money to buy farm produce, and people on the farms did not have the money to buy city products. Two things at that time were especially clear. First, that because of almost unbelievably low prices for farm products, the growers of these products could not meet their indebtedness, could not pay their taxes, could not meet the living expenses of their own families. And the other fact was that in most major crops, a constantly accumulating surplus had reached such absurdly high levels that crop price levels could not possibly rise until something was done to cut down to a reasonable level the bulging surplus that overhung the market. For these reasons, the recovery program that this administration proposed and that Congress enacted was a many-sided one. The administration and the Congress that took office in March 1933 recognized that the emergencies they faced came from many causes and endangered the life of many groups. Consequently, it put the power of government and the resources of government behind not only the railroads and the banks, but the industrial workers of the nation, the farmers, the small homeowners, the unemployed, and the young people who suffered from utter lack of opportunity. It was a great emergency, and it required swift action. You and I know that mistakes were inevitable because it was a new field. And it was also inevitable that time had to elapse before results were fully felt. When the many cells of our economic life were dying for lack of the blood of purchasing power, it took time, after fear had begun to subside, for new vital purchasing power to be diffused once more. But, my friends, that life is coming back. Buoyant, happy life. We need no evidence beyond what we see and hear around us. Justice and common sense. And it's a grand thing when they go hand in hand. Justice and common sense demanded that in the building of purchasing power, we had to start with agriculture. I knew enough of the problems of the men and women who were partners with the soil to realize the depth of their suffering and the extent of their need back there in 32 and 33. I knew the pangs of fear and the moments of rejoicing that come to the farmer as the harvest frowns or smiles. And I realized the almost equally crushing sense of futility that comes to a farmer when, after months of toiling from morning till night, he reaps a bumper crop only to see the prices fall so low that it scarcely pays him to take his crop to market. At this moment, I am not referring to the obvious speculation in stocks and bonds and land booms. You and I know, however, that it is not an inherently good thing for individuals in any nation to be able to make great fortunes by playing the market without the necessity of using much either in the way of toil or of brain. Their tools are not toil or brain. They are a little capital and a good deal of luck. But the kind of speculation I am talking about is the involuntary speculation of the farmer when he puts his crop into the ground. How can it be healthy for a country to have the price of crops vary 300 and 500 and 700%, all in less than a generation? If you invest your savings or your capital in what you consider a fully safe investment, which will conserve your principal so that you will still have that principal intact after 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, you are naturally upset and aghast if the value of that investment drops 50%. And equally, when you make the investment, you do not expect the principal suddenly to go up, to increase 50% in value. And yet, many leaders in this country, not farm leaders, shrug their shoulders and laughed it off when they saw cotton running up and down the scale between 4.5 cents and 28 cents. Wheat running down and up the scale between $1.50 and 30 cents. Corn, hogs, cattle, potatoes, rye, peaches, all crops, all of them fluctuating from month to month and from year to year, 300, 500, 700%, fluctuating in mad gyrations which of necessity have left the growers of them speculators against their will. And that's what we propose to end in America. The measures to which we turn to stop the decline and the rout of American agriculture, originated in the aspirations of the farmers themselves, expressed through the several farm organizations. I turned to these organizations and took their counsel and sought to help them to get these purposes embodied in the law of the land. What you wanted and what you and I have endeavored to achieve was to put an end to the destructive forces that were threatening American agriculture. We sought to stop the rule of tooth and claw that threw farmers into bankruptcy or turned them virtually into serfs, forced them to let their buildings, fences, and machinery deteriorate, made them rob their soil of its God-given fertility, deprived their sons and daughters of a decent opportunity on the farm. To those days, I trust, the organized power of the nation has put an end forever. I say the organized power of the nation advisedly, because you and I, as Americans, who still believe in our republican form of constitutional government, know as a simple fact that 48 separate sovereign states, acting each one as a separate unit, never were able and never will be able to legislate or to administer individual state laws which will adequately balance the agricultural life of a nation so greatly dependent on nationally grown crops of many kinds. And 2 years ago, as a first step, organized agriculture pointed out that it was necessary to bring agriculture into a fair degree of equality with other parts of our economic life. Just so long as agriculture remained a dead weight on economic life, sooner or later the entire structure would crash, as it did in 29. We use for temporary guidance the idea of parity. Parity between farm prices and industrial prices. And as you know, the figures that we use to determine the degree to which agricultural prices had fallen in relation to other prices were based on the figures of 1909 to 1914. This was a fairly satisfactory way of measuring our efforts and our immediate objectives. Those 5 years, 9 to 14, preceding the beginning of the World War, were years of fair prosperity in this country. They were the last years before the widespread disturbance caused by the World War took place in our economic life. And measured by the figures built on this standard, the relative purchasing power of the farmers of America had fallen to less than 50% of normal in early 1933. I promised to do what I could to remedy this, and without burdening you with unnecessary figures, let the record say that a relative purchasing power of below 50% has moved up today to better than 90%. And as I've pointed out before, and as you know, this rise in farm prices has meant a very substantial improvement in the total of the farm income of the country. The best available figures show that it has increased nearly $3 billion in the past 2.5 years. Now, this buying power has been felt in every line of business. Outstanding among those, of course, are businesses like the farm equipment industry, in which employment, mind you, jumped from 27% of the average in October 32 to 116% in October 35. And in the motor car industry, which has found some of its best markets on farms and in small towns, over the same 3-year span, employment has increased from 42% to 105%. These simple figures show how industrial employment in the cities has been benefited by the improvement in the farmers' condition. And let me assure you that you're not the only people who understand this. The city dwellers are beginning to understand it too. Yes, increasing payrolls in the farm equipment and automobile industries in turn are stimulating other lines. Only a few days ago, I noted an item in the papers that I thought was a good illustration. It told of increased activity in the textile mill. One reason, said the newspaper account, was the demand for textiles in the manufacture of automobiles. And there you have the complete chain. The cotton growing south, with more money to spend, buys new automobiles. The automobile makers buy more cotton goods from manufacturers in the Northeast and the Southeast. And these manufacturers, in turn, go into the market for more cotton. Yes, goods are moving again. And as goods are moving, so is money moving once more. And as it flows, millions of farm and city families are getting rightly a bigger share of the national income. I think it is safe to say that although prices for farm products show many increases over depression lows, the farm program as a whole, instead of burdening consumers as a group, has actually given them net benefit. There are individuals whose incomes have not risen in proportion to the rise in certain foodstuffs, but at the same time, the total net income of city dwellers is many billion dollars higher than it was in 1932. And I think you'll agree with me that bargain prices for food in 1932 were little consolation to people in cities who had no income whatsoever. Though food prices in the cities are not on the average as high as they were, for example, in 1928 or 9, yet they are in many cases too high. It's difficult to explain in many cases why, if a farmer gets an increase for the price of his food crop, an increase over what he got 3 years ago, the consumer in the city has to pay two and three and four times the amount of that increase. Lifting prices on the farm up to the level where the farmer and his family can live, you and I know, is opposed chiefly by the few who profited heavily from the Depression. It is they and their henchmen who are doing their best to foment city people against the farmers and the farm program. It is that type of political profiteer, for example, who seeks to discredit the vote in favor of a continued corn hog program by comparing your desire for a fair price for the farmer to the appetite of hogs for corn. But that kind of remark doesn't get very far in the United States. Yes,
I know that the great masses of city people are fair-minded. They, like yourselves, suffered deeply from the Depression. And I believe with all my heart that millions of these city people, struggling back towards better days, resent the attempt of political advantage seekers and profiteers to heap ridicule upon the recovery efforts that all of us are trying to make. And some of the same type of individuals and groups are also trying to stir up the farm population of America against other phases of the broad recovery program. Dispensers of discord are saying that farmers have been victimized by the new reciprocal trade agreement with Canada. And they're painting pictures of a great flood of imports of farm products rushing across the border. But just as I am confident that the great mass of city people are fair-minded, so I am equally sure that the great majority of American farmers will be fair in their judgment of the new trade agreement. Let's put it this way. If the calamity howlers should happen to be right, you have every assurance that Canada and the United States will join in correcting inequality, as good neighbors will do. But I, for one, do not believe for a single moment that the calamity howlers are right. No, agriculture, far from being crucified by this agreement, as some have told you, actually gains from it. We export more agricultural products to Canada than we have imported from her. We shall continue to do so for the very simple reason that the United States, with its larger area of agricultural land, its more varied climate, its vastly greater population, produces far more of most products, including animal products and vegetables and fruits, than does Canada. In the case of the few reductions that have been made, quota limitations are set on the amounts that may be brought in at the lower rate. And on the other side of the picture, we believe, and most unbiased men believe, that the general increase of our trade with Canada, including the exports of our factories, will so add to the purchasing power of hundreds of thousands of wage earners that they will be able to spend far more than they do today for the products of our own farms, our own forests, and our own fisheries. We've heard it before. We hear it every week of our lives. The simple statement that greater trade is merely another word for more production and more employment. And that statement ought to be written up in every farmhouse of the country. But the particular proof of this particular pudding is in the eating. And the best way to judge the new accord is to see how it works out. Analyze, my friend. Analyze the sources of the objection. Analyze the motive of the objector. And remember, too, the old saying, it all depends on whose baby has the measles. But the success that has attended and is attending our effort to stem the depression and set the tide running the other way cannot blind us to the necessity of looking ahead. Ahead to the permanent measures that are necessary to a more stable economic life. We are regaining a more fair balance among the groups that constitute the nation. And we must look to the factors that will make that balance stable. The thing that we're all seeking is justice. The common sense interpretation of that word. The interpretation that means do unto your neighbor as you would be done by. That interpretation means justice against exploitation. Exploitation on the part of those who do not care much for the lives, the happiness, and the prosperity of their neighbors. The nation applauds the efforts of its agencies of government to deal swiftly with kidnappers and gangsters and racketeers. That is justice. The nation applauds the efforts of its agencies of government to save innocent victims from wildcat spankings, from watered stocks, and from all other kinds of confidence games. That is justice. The nation applauds the efforts of government to obtain and to maintain fair rewards for labor, whether it be the labor on the farm, or the labor on the factory, or the labor of the white-collar man. That is justice. Yes, and the nation applauds efforts through the agencies of government to give a greater social security to the aged and to the unemployed, to improve the health of the nation, and to create better opportunities for our young people. That, too, my friends, is justice. And in this quest for justice, we have made progress. It is a lasting progress. Lasting because the people of the nation have learned more about effective cooperation in the past 2.5 years than in the previous 25 years. And so we understand more than ever what that term, the seamless web, means. We seek to balance agriculture and to keep that balance. We have made great strides. But in balancing agriculture, we know that it must be in balance not alone with itself, but with industry and business as well, that the producing public must give and will give consideration to the consuming public. Year by year, as we go on, many details, many problems will need to be analyzed and solved. Agriculture and industry and business, yes, I'm including business, are in overwhelming majorities cooperating for a common justice as never before. In these present days, we have seen and we are seeing not a rebirth of material prosperity alone, of greater significance to our national future is that spiritual reawakening that deeper thinking and understanding that has come to our land. We who strive to dispel the bitterness, to dispel the littleness of the few who still think and talk in terms of the old and utter selfishness, we are working towards the destruction of sectionalism, of class antagonism, and of malice. We who strive for cooperation among all parts of our great population, in every part of the nation, we intend to win through to a better day. Yes, we strive for the United States of America. And if we shall succeed, as by God's help we will, America will point the way towards a better world.